Well, I get the privilege of being up here one more time. Now, we're going to have fun at this summer school. We're going to have a lot of fun. Now, I know that everybody has, you know, their own ideas of what the South is and what the history looks like and all that kind of stuff. Well, that's fine and dandy. I'm just going to speak to you for a few moments tonight on Southern music, and I am by no means the expert on this topic. I am writing about more or less the Appalachian side of Southern culture for my dissertation. That allows me to maneuver, so to speak, around certain politically correct things that I don't really need to be getting into in order to finish my degree. But music is such a fascinating subject, and it defines a great deal about who a people are, and it essentially keeps things in perspective from generation to generation. I remember when I was a boy learning to play the banjo, my mama got up in the middle of the night and slapped Daddy side the head real good and hard. And I heard him hollering down there, "What you do that for?" And she said, "Tell Alan to go shut up. All I can hear is banjo playing all the time." I would practice 4 or 5 hours a day because I was homeschooled and didn't have anything else to do. So people think that I just picked up the banjo and I'm the world's greatest and all this kind of man. No, I just didn't have anything else to do. But anyway, I love it. I love bluegrass music, and I love the old-time country music. And that's more or less the style, the genre that I'm going to be talking about tonight. I had a whole nice, beautiful lecture written out, and it was just every comma was in the right place. It was pretty. I thought, this is hogwash. I'm tired of this. I am tired of writing everything out. I just want to speak to you tonight. If you were at the 2013 Abbeville Institute Scholars Conference, then you may have heard some of this information already. I'm not going to try and regurgitate all of that. But that was 2 years ago, and I doubt any of you remember much of it anyway. So it's going to be good all over again. If we think about Southern music, this term often brings to mind several different genres. I mean, there are several different types of music that originate in the South. You have jazz, and you have blues. You have what we now call country music. You have bluegrass, my personal favorite. You've got Southern gospel. And there are many common traits between all of those genres. Some of these things originate in rural Britain, but I would dare say that most of it originates right here in the South. There are some important European characteristics to the early music, particularly the shape note singing and so forth. And I'm going to get into that in a little more detail. I think Dr. Kibler is going to talk more about that, actually. But I have three primary points tonight. I want to talk about the origins, and I want to talk about the character of Southern music, and then finally what I think we can do with it as a Southern art form going forward. Because it's one of the most valuable contributions that we have as a culture to the world. Our music and our literature are being remembered worldwide. It's not simply something that we enjoy for ourselves. It's appreciated oftentimes among people who are not from the South more than people from the South actually appreciate it. This music that I want to speak about always originates in real experiences. It's not a music that speaks about some type of abstract idea. Now, I know I'm talking more or less about lyrics as opposed to the tunes themselves. And they're sort of two different subjects. But I primarily want to talk about the lyrics that go into the music for a while tonight. The themes of Southern music are always based in real experiences. They don't come from some unidentified gospel of progress where people are simply trying to create some type of Neanderthal sound that just appeals to popular culture. They have meaning. The songs have meaning. Historically, a lot of it does originate in rural Britain, particularly the border country. If we were to look at northern England and southern Scotland and a lot of parts of Ireland, a lot of that balladry is transplanted to particularly the southern Appalachian region. And over time, it becomes a major part of what we now call Southern music. It originates in time of trouble, change, and challenge. The South has a history that's worth celebrating, but it's troubled many times because it reaches several points over the course of the Southern experience where the South is faced with some definition of change, whether we're talking about the 18th century with the Enlightenment and so forth, and many of the principles of the Enlightenment that taught that man is the center of the universe rather than God himself. There's a certain element about Southern society that's always sort of contradicted that, thank God. And over the 19th century, of course, we have the story of the War of Northern Arrogance and all that that entailed. I suppose the aspects of Southern music that we can call Southern prior to the 1860s is more or less the shape note tradition, the shape note singing, gospel music, because there wasn't no bluegrass yet. There wasn't no bluegrass or what we call country music until the 20th century. There was really no jazz or blues necessarily until the 20th century. But over the 19th century, the oldest and most original form of American music is found in the gospel tradition that we see in the shape note hymnals. Now, over the course of the week, we're going to be sharing some clips and some live music to demonstrate some of these tunes. And I hope that you'll be able to see the life that's inside of them, the experience that they tell about. And it's such a, because there's a theology that is to be found in the shape note songs, a theology that is not trying to displace the importance of God in the culture. It's trying to celebrate the importance of God in the culture. The region stays more rural than Britain over the 19th and 20th centuries, and one of the ways that we can say that is by looking at the work of Cecil Sharp, who in 1917, I believe, published a book entitled The English Folk Songs of the Southern Appalachian Mountains. It's a very good book, and his introduction is fantastic. He essentially writes about his attempt to collect songs both in England and in the American South over the course of the 19-teens. And what he finds is very interesting. He finds that most of the people in the South had a recollection of the full ballad rather than simply a part of it. When he was doing his song collecting in the early 20th century in England, he could only find people who knew a part of the ballad. And most people did not know the entire story that the ballad wanted to tell. But he traveled to North Carolina and Charlottesville, Virginia, and various places in North Georgia and Tennessee, and he found many people who knew those ballads in their 18th century form. And he also discovered that many young people knew those songs, as opposed to primarily older people in England. And so what that tells a historian is that there is something about particularly Southern rural culture in the 20th century that much of Europe and the United States up to that point in time had lost, an appreciation for the rural traditions. In graduate school, I oftentimes got in trouble for saying words like tradition without ever explaining what I meant. I mean, these professors, they just nitpick everything. They want you to have absolutely everything perfect. You cannot say, I mean, my God, they are redefining absolutely every word. You can't say Southern without somebody saying, what do you mean by Southern? You can't say music without somebody, what do you mean by music? Tush, I don't have time for this. I've told professors that. I've just got to say this because it's good. I was in my first semester at Mississippi State, and I had a history professor. Well, that's what he called himself anyway. And he was from Michigan. And he wrote a doctoral dissertation on jazz music and, you know, the lyrics of the jazz tradition and that sort of thing. He wouldn't have used the word tradition because he's a flighty character. But anyway, he was in a particular class trying to teach us something about the South, and he said, the South has no tradition worth preserving and no tradition worth learning about, and I disagreed with that. And he said, well, Mr. Harrelson, I happen to have a Ph.D. in Southern History from the University of Georgia. How many of those do you have? I said, I have a Southern history, and that's something you, sir, shall never possess. Yeah, he didn't want to be on my dissertation committee. But anyway, you see poverty coming out in a lot of these tunes. I'm reminded of John Prine, a tune that he wrote entitled Paradise. And in a lot of my work about Appalachian history, this story of the coal mines in the 20th century constantly comes up. People are constantly being moved about because the coal industry is shifting from one place to the next. It's a ridiculous way of life. Because you follow the industry rather than your home, you see. You follow the money rather than a sense of place. And John Prine, his father, was born in a now defunct coal mining town, Paradise, Kentucky. And he himself was born in Illinois. Why? He was born in Illinois in 1947, I think. Well, because his parents moved from Kentucky to Illinois because they had to find some way to make a living. And I don't recollect all the verses to the song. The chorus goes something like this. And I'm going to sing it. Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, way down the Green River where paradise laid. Sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away. You see the story there? It's gone. The town's gone. The entire history of that town, regardless as to whether it was a coal mining town or not, the history of that particular family became embedded in that community over the time that the family lived there. And so the song is a way, according to Prine, for him to honor his father because he did not see his experience as one from Illinois. That was sort of a byproduct of the negative occurrences, the closing down of the coal mines and so forth that had occurred in Kentucky. And I believe Clyde Wilson is going to give us a talk about the diaspora, the southern diaspora, and that's essentially what that song's talking about. You see, southern music is always seeing man in the position of creature as opposed to the creator. There is no hubris involved, such as worshiping man and worshiping man's ability to do everything for himself. What I constantly like to teach my students is that, you know, there is essentially only two ways of looking at the world. You either look at the condition of man as one, you look at man as being sad and a victim of circumstances. He's constantly depressed. He's a victim of circumstances all the time. Victimization. Everybody's victimized, and so you point your finger at somebody else to blame somebody else for the position that you're now in, whatever it may be. The other worldview says that man is depraved. He is in need of a savior. He's born into sin, and without that saving grace, you die in sin. It's not rocket science. It is very simple. There's two kind of people in the world, the saints and the ain'ts. You see that in Southern music over and over and over again. There's a strong evangelical tradition in the shape note tradition and in the Southern gospel music that begins to develop in the 20th century. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm here to tell you today that it is only by the grace and the mercy of God that we're still here. There are many people who are trying to destroy everything about the South, including our musical expressions. But because one of the main themes in that music is not accepted among our culture today. And that music is the dependence of man upon the Creator. I could go into gospel song after gospel song explaining that. I mean, you would know them. I saw the light. I saw the light. No more in darkness, no more in night. Now I'm so happy. No sorrow in sight. Praise the Lord, I saw the light. That's a real experience. That song is not written out of some abstract idea of a relationship with God. It's written out of an actual experience with the Lord. Many times we see tunes being created during the Depression and moving forward through the changes wrought by American modernity over and over and over again. The songs are created as a product of these challenges wrought by American modernity. So geographically, I suppose you could say that some origins can be found in Britain, but I think that the salient point is that it originates here with us, in our experiences. When I went to my comprehensive exams at Mississippi State, and they put me in the room to be grilled by the oral examining board. Four or five professors got together, and they asked me some of the most ridiculous questions you've ever heard in your life. What is the South, and where does it come from? And all these people are born up north. And the only answer I could really think of was, well, it obviously doesn't come from you, so why are you the one asking the question? But that was not acceptable. I don't know that we get anywhere by saying that the music originates in one place or the other. I think that we do get somewhere by explaining the circumstances through which it originates. You understand what I'm saying? The circumstances. I don't believe that what we call Southern music is relegated to one geographical area in the South. You can find it all over the place. You can find bluegrass music in Louisiana and Mississippi, and you can find jazz music in the dark recesses of the Southern Appalachians, all of the hollows and so forth. You can find a great hodgepodge of music. And there was an excellent collection of essays written in 1931, 32, I think it was, the Carolina Low Country. It was published as the Carolina Low Country, and it was sort of a way of discussing the black spirituals that had become predominant in Charleston, in the Low Country. I think that we need to include some of those as well. You cannot talk about a Southern gospel music genre without considering the importance of the spiritual to that. I was raised playing music that did not originate in what we might call white communities. I hate those terms, white and black communities and so forth. It's all coming together to create what we call the South. There are many bluegrass bands today that are singing songs that originated with the black spirituals. And those songs have been raised up in Southern history and Southern culture, and they're still with us today. And the stories are adapted to the times. The character of Southern music always recognizes tension. It always recognizes a tension in the culture. A tension between good and evil, a tension between tradition and modernity. And it should be studied just as well as literature is, because the lyric of a song is nothing more than a piece of art. If it is written and it is written well, based upon an actual experience, then it is a piece of literature that deserves the strongest attention that we can possibly provide it. It builds upon lessons of life. It always builds upon lessons of life. You see, we're at the grassroots level here. What's popular today in music, for instance, is nothing more than platitudes. If you listen to the lyrics in many of the popular songs, it's just nothing more than platitudes. They say the same things over and over again. And it has no meaning. It has no depth. It has no way of speaking to the audience. Because I've discovered over time, in just speaking to college students, that they no longer listen to lyrics. They just listen to the beat. They just want to hear some tribal beat. Don't care anything about the actual lyric. And I know for a fact that if they understood what the song was saying, they would be outraged. But that's beside the point. Music of the South is constantly opposed to that. And I think we can call it, there is such a thing as Southern music, regardless as to those people who don't want to recognize it. Now, Bill Malone argued in 1969 in his Country Music USA that the most predominant form of music in the South is what we would call country music. And he argued that there is a family-style connection in the Southern states that stems from Virginia all the way to Texas. You can try and chop that up however you want to and explain different regions within the South and so forth, but the fact remains that there is a predominant style of family connection between those states from Virginia to Texas, and you can see that in the various types of music that are created in those states, particularly over the course of the 20th century. The first banjo music recording that we have was, I believe, 1926, and Clarence Ashley, I believe, was his name, from the mountains of North Carolina. And that's essentially when the recording business as a whole begins, in the 1920s. The Grand Ole Opry is perhaps the most famous rendition of country music that we have. The Grand Ole Opry has an interesting history. It has always been backed by extremely successful business people around Nashville. It, in and of itself, is not an extremely Southern thing, but it provided a way to disseminate the songs using technology, which was a very important thing, and I'm going to get to the reason why in a minute. Southern music serves as a reflection of truth. I do not understand how we can have any type of discussion about music of the South without a discussion of the gospel music, which is always an important part of it. I was raised on bluegrass gospel music, and I traveled and sang it for a long time. And one of the things that you come to understand about the people who enjoy that type of music is you always have something in common with them. You can travel to Mississippi or Texas or Tennessee or anywhere within the South where the music is played, you find a common ground because there's a familiarity with the music. There's sort of a cultural cohesiveness and a cultural continuity that is, it is allowed to continue because of music, because of literature, because of cultural expression. And I mean truth with a capital T. I do not mean any type of little teeny truths. This is a ridiculous notion that unfortunately many Southerners have also fallen prey to. We have to have everybody's little definition of truth, and no, the best and most lasting forms of Southern art, whether it's music or literature, always reflect an absolute truth. It always reflects this notion that man is in fact the creature, not the creator. Another character of Southern music is it celebrates the good and the permanent things. I'm reminded of a song that Dolly Parton wrote. Oh, yes, I'm going to mention Dolly Parton at the summer school. I like Dolly Parton. She's got two of the biggest blue eyes I have ever seen in my life. Beautiful. I love Dollywood. It's absolutely fantastic. You get to ride the train. They used to have Confederate battle flags on the front of the train at Dollywood. I wonder if they're gone yet. It used to be a wonderful place, but I don't know anymore. And she wrote a song in the 1980s, I think this was written, entitled Smoky Mountain Memories. And the first verse, I'm not going to sing this song because I can't sing that high or that pretty. The first verse says, "You ought to go north, somebody told us, because the air up there holds gold dust, and fortune falls like snowflakes in your hands. Now we live so long on credit. There was no land left to farm." I mean, I forget the lyrics, what the rest of that stanza was. But she was essentially talking about the fact that so many people in the community were moving up north and they were interested in gaining more money in order to support their families. And this was not always a choice. Many times the land had been denuded because of the coal mines, not necessarily in East Tennessee as much as it had been in Western Kentucky. In Eastern Kentucky. But these people needed to go somewhere, and most oftentimes they went to the car plants in Detroit, Michigan. They went to several factories up in Chicago, Illinois. But the chorus of that song is what's so powerful. "These northern nights are dreary, and these old southern eyes are teary, as I wonder how the old folks are back home." So many times, our own people have found themselves displaced, oftentimes because of education. They go to northern schools and they find jobs in northern schools, or whatever the case may be. But so many times they pull out some type of music that reminds them of home. If it hadn't been for music, I don't know how in the world I'd have got through Mississippi State. I know it's still Southern, but it wasn't home. And I would pull that banjo out on a regular occasion, and I would just play to myself and sing to myself songs that I was raised with, songs that reminded me of where I'd come from. And right there, ladies and gentlemen, is one of the main primary lasting points of Southern music. It celebrates the good and the permanent things. It celebrates family. It celebrates absolute truth. It builds upon lessons of faith. I'm sure you yourself can think of songs that you listened to as a child whatever the tradition may have been, whatever the genre may have been. But what is music able to do for us now? I mean, I don't know that I can arbitrarily say that Southern music primarily originates in any one place or that it is characterized by any one thing. Its meaning is, it receives its meaning based upon an individual's experience. For instance, the songs that I value would not be the same that everybody else would value. The songs that people in European countries, for instance, value would not necessarily mean the same thing for us. But I see music as an important cultural preservative. It preserves a particular definition of culture and a proper understanding of life. My grandfather was a songwriter, and it's impossible for me to speak about this subject without getting very personal about it, because ever since the 1950s, my family has been involved in bluegrass and gospel music. He wrote several songs that spoke about his relationship with the Lord, and several of them are still performed in bluegrass music circles today. But what eventually matters is not so much knowledge of who wrote it, but rather where the person was when they first heard it, or what type of situation they found themselves in that allowed that song to speak to them. Southern music helps people keep sight of who they are. You place a mirror in front of that particular person, because when you are performing music, and this is one of the things that the South has always done far better than other cultures in Western civilization. You speak to the audience because you understand the audience is not necessarily interested in learning more about you. They're interested in learning something about themselves. And that's what a song written from a Southern tradition is going to accomplish. It's going to show the audience something about itself. It can be humorous. It can be glorious. It doesn't make any difference. Oh, Lord. There was a comedian on the Grand Ole Opry several years ago, and he wrote a song entitled, "If My Nose Were Running Money, I'd Blow It All on You." I tried to use that as a pickup line in a bench downtown Charleston one day. It didn't pan out too good. Oh, my goodness. And it seems to me that that's one of the things that the world has forgotten how to do, is to simply laugh and have a good time and to celebrate. Everything doesn't have to be serious all the time. The one major part of Southern art that it seems to me has not been studied nearly enough is Southern humor. And that can be found in literature as well as in song. I mean, I'm reminded of all the wonderful work that Ray Stevens did, the wonderful work that Jerry Clower did, because he was not a songwriter. He wrote stories and he told stories. But why did he receive a career in Nashville, Tennessee? And why did they put him on the Grand Ole Opry, a place that was known primarily for music? Because the music told a story. It's not about who has the greatest talent and who can make the most money over the course of their lifetime playing it. Traditional Southern music, whether you're talking about country or bluegrass or whatever the case may be, never originates with a business plan. It originates for enjoyment. Why don't people just enjoy things anymore? You always have to make money doing absolutely everything. And that's why there are so many wonderful talents in the South today and people don't know anything about them. There's so much talent everywhere. There's always been the case. You know about the people who were the recording artists, particularly beginning in the 1920s and moving up through today. We know who those people are. But we know nothing about those people who never sought a career in the music, who never sought a business plan, who never followed after an almighty dollar, but they simply wanted to enjoy the music at the time that it was performed. If you were to study bluegrass music, what you would see is that, okay, we have something called bluegrass music. It begins in the 1940s with Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys at the Grand Ole Opry. First show they ever have at the Grand Ole Opry. If you go to the Ryman Auditorium today, downtown Nashville, they have a beautiful sign out in the front. It says, "This is the birthplace of bluegrass music." Wow. Not very many people care about it. They're always going to get drunk somewhere or whatever it is they're going to do. But I sat and I read that thing one day. I said, you know, this is of major historical significance for Southern culture. Bluegrass music begins here. Bill Monroe, Earl Scruggs, Lester Flatt, they are beginning a new genre, which was produced out of the old-time traditions that had been known in the mountains for several generations. But what you notice about bluegrass music is that it hasn't changed much at all in the past 70 years. The same songs are still played over and over and over again. The same people who were playing music in the 40s and the 50s, they're still revered because they were the pioneers. For years, people have tried to change what bluegrass music sounds like. They've tried to create new types of instrumentation and new ways of playing old songs, but it never works because the audience is not interested in seeing who can come up with the latest and greatest and the newest thing. They're interested in tradition and hearing the same song in the same way that their daddy and their mama heard it, that their grandparents heard it. I'm reminded of the old Alabama song, "Oh, play me some mountain music like grandma and grandpa used to play, and I'll go on down the river to a Cajun hideaway." It matters that you enjoy the same music that your ancestors enjoyed. But when listen, why is it that we no longer have a culture that is interested in the old lyrics, in the old music? They're constantly trying to live their life through this popular culture and this popular music genre. I mean, it's a dangerous time in a culture. I don't know that you can call it a civilization anymore. When people worship some type of music idol. I mean, who are these stupid-looking people? I mean, who was that dude who had his hair hanging down over his eyeballs and everything? Justin Bieber or whatever his name was? I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, our young people, the agrarians in 1930, if you listen and pay attention to what the agrarians were trying to do in 1930, you read their statement of principles, and what do they say? They say, "We are interested in capturing the attention of our young people." Our young people today are more interested in who Miley Cyclops is than they are about the traditions that their parents created, that their grandparents created. It's a major problem. Why do we have that? Because the music came out of a primarily agricultural civilization that no longer exists. The audience is no longer there. You hear what I'm saying? The audience has changed. And if we're going to say that Southern music matters because the audience is interested in learning something about themselves, then we no longer have an audience for bluegrass and country music in the old sense that is going to reach a people. It's kind of like you're sort of a dinosaur if you play a banjo anymore. Of course, it's never been really popular. Somebody lied to me when I was a child. They told me that banjo picking attracts all the pretty ladies. I had a 90-year-old woman came up to me the other day at the church. And she said, "I believe that it's God's will that you and I get married." I said, "You've got to be kidding." She said, "No, I love you." And come to find out, she was lusting after my banjo music. I cannot believe this. What has happened with the generations? I mean, are you not supposed to enjoy good music until you're like 70 or 80 years old or something like that? You're scared of what people are going to think? Daddy told me that if I got a two-door sports car and a banjo and went and played it around town a little bit that I'd get me a wife in about 2 weeks. People go to hell for lying. You don't see any wedding band, do you? God help me. I've got to stop with that because I could get in trouble. You see, the music is preserving the culture. It's preserving a proper understanding. When I hear a song such as I Saw the Light or Will the Circle Be Unbroken or By and By When the Morning Comes. You ever heard of that song before? By and by when the morning comes, all the saints of God are gathering home. Well, we'll tell a story how we've overcome and we'll understand it better by and by. That's happy. I mean, it's joyful. It's not a dirge or anything. It's just happy. We have a reputation of being a happy people, a people that enjoy celebrating their culture. And within these attacks that we're seeing upon our culture today, I mean, why is it making people mad rather than people just learning to appreciate more about who they are and where they come from? I am Southern, and I'm not going to apologize for that. I play bluegrass music, and I'm not going to apologize for that. Although Daddy should apologize for me for lying the way he did. Music serves as our battle cry of freedom. Let me explain that. Music serves as our battle cry of freedom. As long as we still have our songs, as long as we still have our tunes and our lyrics that we love and that we appreciate, we still exist as a people. We still have a history and an experience that we can share through a valued art form. And music needs to be art. It needs to be an actual expression of something that matters to you, not something that Nashville or Los Angeles tells you that you need to enjoy because it's mainstream culture and everybody else is doing it. Why does the South continue to matter, particularly in its music? It matters because it is one of the few things from an older American civilization that cannot be destroyed. How are you going to destroy music if it is embedded in the hearts and the minds of a people? Technology can change the way the music is performed. It can change the way it is distributed and recorded, of course. But ultimately, that in and of itself is not going to alter the meaning of the music itself. The only way the music can be destroyed is if we allow it to. If we reach a point where we don't care about this older music. Oh, so many people when I was going to college, they thought that bluegrass and country music were for redneck backwoods people. Oh, you cannot be sophisticated and play a banjo at the same time. Let me tell you what sophistication means. Sophistication is just another word for a complicated phony. Ricky Skaggs came out with a good song in the 1980s, and it was entitled, Don't Get Above Your Raisin. Why do Southern people read other people's literature? Listen to other people's music. Go to somebody else's university. I don't understand that. We have our own music and our own literature in our own schools. And we should appreciate them. We should cultivate them. So, very briefly, I don't want to belabor this because my hour was from 7 to 8 and we are nearly at 8 o'clock now. If you are very interested in a more detailed lecture about origins and so forth, the scholar's lecture that I provided in 2013 is posted online. There are many people here today who are new faces, and I look forward to meeting all of you. But what I personally want you to take away from this lecture are three things. Number one, Southern music always originates in times of change, in times of trouble, and great challenge. That doesn't mean that all of the songs are depressing. It just means that during times of change and challenge, the Southern people have always been good at expressing who they are. And music and literature are our two most valued ways of doing that. Number two, the character of Southern music always builds upon real lessons of life. Lessons that you would learn from your parents. Lessons that you would learn from trial and error, for instance. It's a very conservative thing. Thirdly, Southern music helps us keep sight of who we are. There are so many artists, so many different recording studios that we could discuss if we wanted to talk about the practical nuts and bolts history of this business. I'm not interested in that for you this evening. I just want you to know that one of the best ways that we can take our stand, so to speak, is to simply celebrate the South through the various art forms that we currently enjoy. Thank you for your time.